In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 393. How do we persuade people, really of anything, but particularly of the liberty message? That's the topic of conversation today with Michael Malice. You've heard Michael on this show before, no doubt. You may also have seen him on Fox Business, in particular on Kennedy, where you can hear him commenting on all kinds of issues from his unique perspective. He is the author of Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. He is also a celebrity ghostwriter. You can find out all kinds of things about Michael over at michaelmalice.com. And of course, plenty about him on the show notes page for today, which is tomwoods.com/393. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Michael Malice. Michael Malice, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
I have people who are just nuts about Michael Malice, and I have people who say, if you have that Malice on one more time, that is the last straw.
So, is that true?
I'm not really sure, but I did get some bad feedback with the episode we did on the police. I got some fantastic glowing feedback saying, boy, that was courageous and gutsy, and we love this guy. And I had some people saying, you know, you're just taking things too far. You're throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Well, sometimes that baby needs throwing out, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I always tell them, you know, of course you throw out the baby with the bathwater when it's a demon baby.
Yeah. What if it's Damien?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's what I say when I was talking about getting rid of the Fed. They say, oh, okay, the Fed's made some mistakes, but you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. That demon baby.
Mistakes were made.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Indeed. Indeed. All right. Today we're going to talk about instead of a specific topic, as you say, we're going to go meta, to use this annoying term. We're going to look at things. We're going to look at how it is that we persuade people, how it is that we bring people over to our point of view. Because let's face it, our point of view, you know, is sort of the minority position. Like every time I feel encouraged that we're really making progress, some really... And I say this as somebody who comes out of the conservative movement. Some really low IQ conservative meme is up there on Facebook, and it's got 58,000 likes. You know, if I had 88 lifetimes, I couldn't get that many likes on a meme. And this happened in 10 seconds. So it makes me feel like, oh, you know, maybe we're not making the progress I think, or it's going to be a longer slog than I thought. So
well, I don't know if it's a numbers game on our part. I mean, the goal isn't to get as many people as possible. It's just to get the right people, right?
No, that absolutely is true. But at the same time, it is demoralizing all the same to see how many people will just mindlessly click on that thing. But you're right. I mean, it is a matter of... Because we could get a whole lot of people who are going to click like on a meme and then go back to playing video games all day,
right.
And that doesn't do us any good. So
actually, it does us a lot of good. Wouldn't you rather they be playing video games than be, you know, causing trouble with the state?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I mean if they were on our side, it wouldn't do us a lot of good. I'm glad they're playing video games.
As a matter of fact,
there's a particular person, I can't say his name, but this is a person who has done a lot of damage, I think, because of his association with the Ron Paul movement. And I was told that he was not a very hard worker in whatever it is that he does, and that he basically plays video games all day. And I thought, great! He's doing much less damage. It's the Obama playing golf principle. I'd rather have him play golf. All right, listen. I'm talking too much here. So, let's start off, though, with that point. You already jumped in with something interesting. It's not the number of people you get. It's the quality of the people you get. Expand on that. Which people are we trying to reach?
Well, it's interesting because I've been on a couple of these anarcho-capitalist Facebook groups, and they all are – I think a lot of these kids have a basic error in their approach, which is they're trying to achieve non-democratic ends. through democratic means. And they really think that, I don't know what they're thinking, but it sounds like they think we're going to have 100, you know, anarchist senators, and they're going to pass a bill declaring America and Capistan. And that's not how it works. And I think what more people need to realize, because, you know, you grow up in a government school and you're taught government propaganda, the government and the state is going to act the way it wants independently, largely, of public opinion. So having a lot of people one way or another, I wrote an article about this for The Guardian about, you know, why I don't vote. Like the healthcare bill was a perfect example of this. You know, all the polls were violently against it. The Democrats, for rightly or wrongly, thought this was the right thing to do, and they just went ahead. So this idea that if we persuade everyone to our point of view that freedom is going to be a consequence, the state's going to dig in its heels unless it absolutely has to, don't you think?
I do and I don't. For example, the bailouts are another good example of what you're talking about. The polls right. were dead set against this. The calls into the congressional office were dead set against it, and yet it went through anyway. But on the other hand, I don't think there was going to be a spontaneous movement at any level of government to decriminalize marijuana. I think that's a case where you did have the people leading, where there was a very dramatic and sudden shift in public opinion. And I think in that case, the politicians did follow. Am I wrong?
Sure. But I mean, again, I think this is very much a marginal issue. I don't think incarceration rates have decreased. At some point, you know, there's going to be some things in the margin. Sure. But in terms of, you know, deconstructing the edifice of the federal government, it's still there. And so I think this is kind of losing the forest for the trees on that issue, although I definitely concede that point.
All right, let's talk about styles and persuasion styles, because you and I are different, and there are people I've had on this show who are different from both of us. Like, everybody has a unique approach. And I sometimes am accused of two mutually exclusive things. On the one hand, I over-intellectualize things. I'm too respectable with my coat and tie and, you know, laying out my arguments. And then on the other hand, I get told I'm too much of a firebrand and I gotta tone it down and stop being so confrontational. So maybe they're just seeing me on different days or something, because I see myself in both of those descriptions. I'll tell you a little bit about the way I've approached this, but I'm curious to really know your approach. I mean, I've seen you on Fox Business.
Right.
I've read your articles, and when I read your articles, I don't find you to be a million miles removed from my writing style.
Okay.
So yeah. So what's your overall approach, your philosophy? I mean, you are a Randian.
Kinda.
Well, in the sense that I know that I can tell what you think. Well, I have a pretty good instinct about what you think about appealing to the masses.
Well, yes. I mean, that's not from Rand. That's from, like, the Italian elitist.
But it could also be from Rand. I mean, she wrote her books, and we'll see where things go. But I mean, you remember when Mises wrote that letter to Rand talking about how wonderful Atlas Shrugged was, and he said, "You had the guts to tell people, especially the broad mass of the public, look, you are inferior, and all the developments that have improved your standard of living came about because of people who are better than you." Like, I mean, that is a way of looking at society that I think is more or less in line with her views.
But I'm just going to say one thing. I think people who are in the liberty movement need to understand that for a large percentage of the population, which is higher than 10% but less than 40%, saying that you like Rand is conceptually identical to saying you're a Scientologist.
Yeah, I know. I mean, when did this happen?
I think this has been happening from the beginning with the NBI days, don't you think?
No, I don't know enough about the institutional history, but I do know enough, having been around for a while, that before we became kind of cool and hip, we being libertarians, there were few enough of us that we didn't go around saying, well, you know, Mises wasn't compromising enough or whatever. We all just glad to meet somebody who was kind of in our camp. And it's only recently, it's only really since the Ron Paul days, that I find there are especially younger libertarians who kind of turn up their noses at some of the great names of the movement. Like, I don't need Rothbard or whatever. I don't need Rand. I don't need any of these people because they had all, you know, this shortcoming or that shortcoming. I can develop all the ideas purely out of my own head, which seems to be the implication.
No, I think this is actually the implication. So I think probably like in the 80s or so, there was a big argument, which in retrospect was absurd, about whether someone can be, you know, very religious and be a libertarian. And the answer is, of course, right? And a lot of these objectivists, Rand very much made this a package deal that if you want to be for liberty, you have to be a militant atheist, you know, and this kind of nonsense. So I think what we're seeing now is, you know, people who are ideologues of the progressive persuasion, which is its own version of religion, are being attracted to libertarianism, and they're trying to bring their own religion and make this kind of syncretic mix of the two. So part of their, you know, ideology is heavily based on egalitarianism. Rothbard, of course, wrote explicitly against egalitarianism. Rand could not be any more anti-egalitarian if she tried. So I think that's where their need to repudiate these people comes from.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought of it that way. I knew that part of the history, but it just seems to be a feature of, again, the sort of younger generation that, and I'm sorry, I sound like an old man to say these younger kids, they don't read books. But I mean, some of them do. There's a wing of them maybe associated with the more DC-ish, fashionable, chic libertarians who really are almost contemptuous of great figures who came before them. It's not to say we have to worship these people, but, you know, for heaven's sake, we ought to learn from them. And speaking of these people, let me say something about Murray Rothbard, because his own approach to spreading these ideas is very interesting, because he didn't have just one approach. He wrote, if you read Man, Economy, and State, his great economic treatise, it's written in a very scientific idiom. It's not written in his punchy style that he would have written in the Libertarian Forum newsletter, or that he would have given in a speech. It's very, very dispassionate, technical writing, but he felt like economics needs this. It needs a pure dose of Austrianism. It needs this reconstruction. So he did that. He did a book on the Great Depression. Again, right. Very scholarly, very great history, great economics. But then on the other hand, when he would reach out to the general public and he'd write newspaper articles or he'd give speeches, very punchy. It wouldn't be so much of, well, you know, here's how the business cycle works. It was more of, these people are ripping you suckers off. Because he realized that some people are going to be reached through that, through this sense of, doggone it, I am being screwed here. So he had a different approach to different audiences.
Well, I'm going to say something very, you're not going to like.
No, Michael Malice, no.
I think Rothbard in many ways is a real villain of libertarianism.
Oh, all right. We're switching the subject of the whole show now.
And I think a lot of the abhorrent behavior we're seeing in contemporary left libertarianism has its roots in Rothbard. And by this is what I mean. Rothbard throughout his career made it a point of denigrating in snide and condescending terms and personal terms people who he had formerly been allied with, people who are still on the same team. And I have absolutely no – he went after Rand with that play, Mozart is Red. He went after Ed Crane, the former chairman of the Cato Institute, who I'm not a fan of. But he, you know, he wrote this vituperative letter about how Ed Crane's the devil. And by the end of his life, you know, he was such a pariah. He has to, you know, try to build a bridge to Pat Buchanan, of all people. So I think Rothbard is a perfect example of someone who had the exact wrong strategy. If you hate someone, and there's no one who hates more people than me. I don't think the way to get people on your side is to attack people personally, individually, and by name, because who's going to want to associate with you wondering when the other shoe is going to drop?
Well, see, I can't agree with you, because I know so many people Rothbard remained very close with to the end of his life who held exactly the same views as the people he wound up tangling with. Neil McCaffrey, for example, was a traditionalist Catholic right out of the Bill Buckley mold. He was always around National Review magazine, and they maintained a very close relationship to the end, even though he founded the Conservative Book Club. He was associated with all kinds of things Rothbard couldn't stand. But nevertheless, they remain friends. I can find many examples of this. And also, I mean, if we have his voluminous correspondence at the Mises Institute, and it doesn't seem to bear this out. He maintains, regardless of what back and forths appeared in public, he maintains very cordial correspondence with a lot of people. And with Ed Crane, I mean, I'm not so sure I can really blame him, given some of the early turns that the Cato Institute was taking and the way it was shifting in response to donors. And I can understand his exasperation in that situation. But my point is, I mean, if our subject today, more or less, is how do you reach the public? How do you spread the ideas? In a way, I've kind of followed in his footsteps in the sense that I do write, I don't much anymore because I'm sick of doing it, but I do write scholarly articles. I do write books for academic publishers so that I can say, here's my lasting contribution. But I don't want to spend my life doing that because, frankly, not that many people read those things. I would rather get out there in front of large audiences and somehow take complicated ideas and distill them so that they grab people. They make people want to be part of this movement. And of course, if you're just bitter and angry, who's going to say, yeah, I want to be part of that? Now, we have plenty angry about.
Whoa.
Go ahead. You're going to make an argument for bitterness and anger?
You don't think bitterness and anger have mobilized movements throughout history?
No, it's true. I know.
I'm not even joking.
No. Look at communism. That's true. That was not based on. We just have a few strategic differences with the provisional government. It was not that. That is true.
I mean, this is where I strongly disagree with so many people in libertarianism. This idea that if you're kind and nice, people are going to, glom onto you. When if you look at the data. Aggression and antagonism are far more of a magnet for people who want to be surrounded by strength and kind of being told what to do. That's how it works in nature with, schools of fish, packs of dogs. And I think it would behoove libertarians to study, zoology a bit more because so many people are operating on some kind of, animal level. And this idea, if you're friendly, people are going to be loyal to you. It's not true. This kind of thing, even with dating, like nice guys finish last. I think people historically are very much drawn to those who validate their envy and their antagonism and their anger. The left exploits this beautifully. So that's money on the table that would be left behind.
That is true. That there is certainly something to that. I guess in my own public persona, let's say, when I'm engaged in public speaking, I try to transfer that into humor.
Sure.
So that it's not just I'm up there, pointing my finger because that gets boring. But I transmute it into mordant humor, and it seems to work.
But
and,
there's this. Sorry, go ahead.
No. You go. I'm talking way too much in this conversation. You're the guest.
There's this idea in the liberty movement that things like quote-unquote negative emotions and negative appeals are not legitimate. And this is just a new age, piece of BS. If it's part of our social psychology, that's something to exploit. So I really have a big problem with this. But let me just speak to something else, which is, I think, a broader issue with people in general and libertarians maybe specifically, which is the complete lack of empathy a lot of people have. And by empathy, I don't mean caring about other people. I mean the ability to understand how other people think. When you're talking to a leftist, you have to speak to them differently than when you're talking to a conservative. And most libertarians will say, I think X, Y, and Z are the most important values. They'll regard it at prima facie. It's like this obvious thing. And when someone disagrees with them, they'll just call that other person stupid and have absolutely no attempt to look at things from their perspective. And this is something that people who want to persuade really need to learn. And I only learned this because I write books for celebrities. I have to be able to write in their voice. So this was a skill that took me many years to develop. And I see an absolute dearth of it on Facebook and people I speak with.
Now, in light of your views of human nature or the way people are reached. How have those insights that you have affected the way you yourself have gone about this task?
Well, let me give you a good example, okay? I'm Jewish. That means very little to me. However, I 100% will have if I have any sons, circumcised because I'm not going to let this piece of crap, snotty kid not get circumcised and repudiate thousands of years of, suffering just so he can be holier than thou.
All right. By the way, I'm going to get a ton of emails saying, why didn't you challenge Michael Malice because he wants to mutilate his son? And, I'm sorry, listen to another podcast then if you want me to berate people. I'm not going to do it. So
that's a very separate issue, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Fine. And let's suppose you're talking to someone who's African-American. And the first thing to them, the right to vote is a profound, even though it's irrelevant, you know, voting doesn't matter one way or another. To them, this is something that people who look like them, who were their relatives, had to deal with a lot of humiliation and oppression to get that right. So if you're going to speak to someone like that, if you're going to open with, you know, voting's a fraud, blah, 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 it has some symbolic emotional resonance, which is not false. So this is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. If you're going to have someone who's an ANCAP, every once in a while they flick a switch, even for Hillary, is that really count as a loss in our column?
All right, fair enough. But I still don't see – I want to know exactly when Michael Malice tries to get people to agree with him. There are multiple ways of trying to do that. And which one do you choose based on what you think is likely to work?
Well, the first thing you have to do is to look at a person and recognize what their values are, what their, you know, what they find important, what they don't find important. Jonathan Haidt has this great book called The Righteous Mind, and he basically breaks it down. There's seven axes that people care about: fairness, hygiene. I forget what all the seven were. So when you're let's suppose you're talking to someone who, wants income equality, right? And you are of the belief in an anarchist society there would be less income disparity. You don't come in and say, I also believe in income equality, but you have to argue with them on their turf. They're not going to let you in the house unless you're willing to validate their context and accept it as true, even just for the sake of the discussion.
I've been able to do that, for instance, when Meltdown came out and people were beginning to talk about the Federal Reserve. I went on a number of progressive radio shows. They had never heard the Austrian theory of the business cycle or anything, but the way I explained it to them did resonate with them because it seemed like, aha, okay, so there's some manipulation going on, and as usual, the most vulnerable people wind up getting, you know, left hanging out to dry when the whole thing has collapsed. They were willing to accept that, well, you know what, I had never thought of this as another way that the average Joe is getting screwed. And if that's the way people want to look at Austrian theory of the business cycle and the Fed, I'm perfectly at peace with that, and I haven't betrayed anything I believe in. And yet I was able to speak to people who basically are egalitarians and their first principles are all screwy. But if I can get that foot in the door, if I can open that door a crack and I can get them to think about one of my ideas, maybe they'll think about another one, and maybe they'll think about another one. And then that's how people change, when they realize, wait a minute, these ideas are not disjointed. They make sense. They're all integrated.
That's right. And I when I talk to people like that, what I tell them is, you know, the weakest people are the most vulnerable to government shenanigans by definition. And when you put it in those terms, that's exactly terms that they speak and they understand. And a lot of times people on the right side of anarchism are so anti-progressive that as soon as someone starts speaking progressive jargon, they're going to dig their heels in as well. And I saw a good example of this on Facebook where someone was saying, you know, the whole Baltimore thing, they were arguing against police brutality and that being the cause of all this. And I said, would you rather there be egalitarian police brutality, right? That all races were being beaten equally. Would that be an improvement? And the guy made a very good point. He goes, yes. Because if people like Michael Bloomberg's son were getting beaten, then there would be enough people to actually do something about the issue instead of being able to say, not my problem, sweep it under the rug. So when he put it in those terms, that actually made a lot of sense. But when you first hear someone being like, you know, racism, police brutality, you think this is just going to be liberal claptrap and you're going to shut your ears off.
Yeah, it really is true. And it's demoralizing how quickly people resort to familiar and comforting slogans, no matter what the issue is. With foreign policy, with the economy, people have got three or four slogans, and that's it. And then they shout them at each other all day, and they make memes about them with talking frogs or beer-drinking guys or whatever. What do you think in terms of what would be productive for people to do, what would be unproductive for people to do, if you had to give advice to listeners of this show, practically all of whom are trying to spread what is, you know, an unpopular message, let's face it. What advice would you give? Or what's a waste of their time and what might be a better use of their time?
Well, I would say when you're having an argument with someone you're disagreeing with, assume that they are a rational actor, just for the sake of argument, right? And given that they're a rational actor, what axioms are they basing their ideology on that you can kind of leave aside for the moment because an axiom is not open to change? And how can you take those axioms and, you know, build on that to have a bridge between what they think and what you think? And another argument I just got into this week is what people need to realize is most human beings start their moral reasoning with the idea that I am a good person. And it goes from I'm a good person, I like X or I hate Y, therefore good people like X and hate Y. And that's how they start their thinking. You've always seen on TV people saying, I'm a good mother, I love my son. I've never heard anyone say I'm a bad mother, but there's plenty of bad mothers out there. When you realize that people regard it as the basis of their thinking, that what they think is good, and the idea that they have – there's a good out there that might be different from what they've just deduced from the ethos, it opens up a lot of doors in terms of approaching them and arguing with them.
Let's talk for a minute before we wrap up about Fox Business, where you appear somewhat regularly. You were on The Independents, and now you're on Kennedy quite a bit. What are you trying to accomplish, other than getting your name out there, of course, which we all want, but what are you trying to accomplish when you're on a show where you're going to get a brief chance to talk, then somebody else is going to talk, then you get a brief chance to talk? What are you aiming to do there? You're trying to educate the public? You're trying to shock the public? What are you trying to do?
My first priority is always to mock and denigrate politicians personally. And to make them subjects of ridicule, if not contempt. And then hopefully I'll be able to get a few sound bites in that have good ideas that will – if I'll say something that's banal, I'll say it hopefully in an interesting way that maybe will make some people just repeat that funny little sound bite. But I'm not under any expectation to change minds. I'm just there to have fun and – I think it's very important to not give the state the moral, apparatus, and to regard it as something sacrosanct when it should be something that is regarded with contempt.
Before I let you run, I'd like you to recommend, just off the top of your head, whatever occurs to you, a few books that you think really are the kind of books that can either change minds or at least get people thinking in ways they hadn't thought before.
Sure. The most important one is The Machiavellians by James Burnham, who was a Trotskyite, and then he wrote for National Review. And he just discusses elite theory and how the nature of the government's independent of the masses always and by definition. Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind, I mentioned earlier. Steven Pinker's book, which I'm completely what's it called? The Modern Denial of Human Nature. I'm blanking on the title. I can't believe it. Those three are very, very useful to unpack and understand how most people actually think and operate. Because I think people think that persuasion is just, I throw logic, you throw logic, and whoever has more logic wins. And it's not that way at all. It's operating, in this background machinery that we all have in our minds. And that's where you have to figure out how to persuade people. It's not through strength of facts, or else we would have won, right?
Well, no doubt. I will link to all those books as well as to michaelmalice.com on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/393. If I didn't have to run, I would talk to you for another half an hour. But unfortunately, I'm under a time crunch today. And it's my wife's birthday today.
So, happy birthday, Heather.
Yeah, she's great. So we have a bunch of things going on today. So I have to cut short my otherwise wonderful conversation with Michael Malice. But boy, I've gotten ideas for like three more conversations just from this one. So anyway,
good.
thanks for talking to me today. I hope to see you soon.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
All right, a couple quick things before I let you go. Number one, I misspelled McQuestion yesterday in the episode in which I played the interview with Doug Casey, where we were talking about anarchism on the McQuestion PBS program. It's not a Q, it's MCC. McQuestion. I think I was thinking of like Steve McQueen. That is a Q, but it is C. So just so you know, we fixed it on the show notes page. But in the episode, I'm still spelling it with a Q. I thought that would help you if I spelled it. I spelled it wrong. So sorry about that. Second thing is, unfortunately, my trip to Ireland has fallen through. It's a long story, just a bizarre set of circumstances, and it's too bad. And I do hope to get there someday. I'm very much intending to do that. But for the time being, that has fallen through. I have a trip coming to Idaho. I'm not totally sure that it's entirely open to the public. Coming up in June, this is 2015 that I'm speaking to you. And let's see, in September, we're working on events, one near Winter Park, Colorado, and another one that was going to be in Oklahoma City but may be in Atlanta now for September. I'll be speaking in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in early October at the Mises Circle in Dallas. So all my events, as always, you can find at tomwoods.com/events, and you can find out about by getting my newsletter. Just go to tomwoods.com, and right at the top, just click where it says Notify Me. And in addition to getting my newsletter, you will also get my free ebook, 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered. It is a great book. You will enjoy it. You will get some serious ammunition for yourself by reading it, and it's absolutely free at tomwoods.com. So make sure and check those things out. Remember the show notes page, tomwoods.com/393. And our friend Michael Malice, whom you will find linked there in terms of his website, his Twitter. Lots of fun Michael Malice stuff over at tomwoods.com/393. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week.
The Tom Woods Show.